Have you ever felt like you were in a situation that was far bigger than yourself? Maybe it was a project at work, a challenging family dynamic, or a new role you felt unqualified for? Well, for me, one of these moments was back in about 2002. I was working for Office Depot as an assistant manager, and I'd recently been transferred back to the training store for the entire state, after only 2 years of being promoted myself from that actual same store. Shortly after my transfer, we began plans to relocate the store to a better location only about a mile away, a brand new store, a brand new building. And I was put in charge of the existing store, and the store manager and the assistant manager were at the new location getting it all set up, as well as some of our staff. Well, I'd only been with the company for about 6 years, right, I had been with them for about 6 years, but only the assistant for about two, so it was still kind of a new role for me to be in, to kind of be the guy in charge. But I couldn't let my feelings of trepidation show in front of all of these people who had just trained me just a couple of years before. Clearly, I made it through. I'm here. The new store was opened. We closed the old one down. And as a result, I did get some credit with the top leadership. And as a result, I got asked to go to a new store that was really struggling and kind of help get them straightened out. So I was able to make it through that moment. Today, we're going to look at one of the greatest leaders in history, Moses, and see how he navigated a truly monumental task, leading the people out of slavery and through the wilderness. The story of Moses is not just an ancient history lesson. It's a profound blueprint for leadership, a guide for how to handle responsibility, build up others, and find purpose in the most difficult circumstances. Our texts are going to be from mostly Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, ironically. They focus on the journey through the desert. We'll explore several key principles that can apply to our own lives. So as the program says, my name is Aaron, and the title of this morning's study is Dwelling with Intention, Sukkot's Lessons for Today, but I'll get into that in a moment. First, let me tell you a little bit about myself, since this is only my second year with all of you. I grew up in the Seventh-day Adventist Church and went to Seventh-day Adventist schools from first grade all the way through graduation and then freshman year in college. I worked at an SDA summer camp for 8 years as well, so Sabbath has been part of my life for as long as I can remember. However, I wasn't a feast keeper until 11 years ago, this month actually, thanks to my beautiful wife right over here. It's her fault that I'm here. So if I screw up, you can blame her. Both of us have also had a long SDA background. She started keeping feasts back in 2010. Since that time, both of us have really been learning about all of the feasts. Since I left last year from here, I began a character study on Moses, and having spent the last year reading both the New Testament and the Torah, two separate readings. So this is where this study is coming from today. Now, one thing more before we get started. The title, specifically the word Sukkot, this may be a new word for you while sounding familiar. Sukkot is a Hebrew word. It is very similar to the word Sukkoth, which is the first place the Israelites go when leaving Egypt. Now, Josh touched on this a little bit the other day. Succoth is a place where Jacob lived right after wrestling with God. Remember, this is also where Jacob's name gets changed to Israel. So the first stops the Israelites make after nearly 400 years of enslavement is the first place Jacob, now Israel, lives after wrestling with God and is given a new name. I found that a bit interesting when I was putting that together. Succoth means temporary shelter. This is where we get the word sukkah from, as well as Sukkot. It also translates as booth, dwelling place, and tabernacle. So Succoth, Feast of Booths, Feast of Tabernacle, all the same thing. None is better than one another. So I'm used to saying Succoth, so from when I first learned it. So when I say Succoth, Feast of Tabernacles, same thing. We all know what we're talking about. Okay. Now, with all of that out of the way, we'll start with Exodus 18:13. On the next day, Moses sat to judge the people. The people stood around Moses from morning till evening. So imagine the scene. Not too much different than that, I would imagine. Hundreds of people with grievances, conflicts, questions. They came to Moses from morning till evening, every single day. He was the sole judge, the only one trusted to solve their problems. He was doing everything. It was a recipe for disaster and burnout, a sure path to frustration, and it was deeply inefficient. So my question, why was Moses the guy they all went to? Remember, this would have been a rather large group. We get the first census in the opening chapter of Numbers. It only counts the names, it only counts the number of the age of people 20 or so and younger, or older, sorry, and only those who would be able to serve in the army. That number that we have is 603,550. So by the time you add anybody, any men under 20, men too old or not able to fight, then double it for all the women that would be there. And then, of course, all the children. That number is going to end up close to 2 million. It's the guess, but basic math is going to get you near 2 million. Well, 2 million is about 60% of the population of Utah, just for comparison's sake. So I don't think that we're just going to walk up to the governor and say, hey, my neighbor over here took my shovel and he won't give it back. I need you to take care of the situation. Well, that's what's going on in the desert. Let's think about our own lives. Any of you who lead a team of people, whether it's at work or a nonprofit committee or a church committee, when you are the person that has the experience and direction, people come to you. Well, that's Moses. Exodus 18 tells us about a critical turning point. Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, saw the unsustainable model and asked, why is this thing that you are doing for the people? Why do you sit alone and all the people sit around you from morning till evening? Brings us to Exodus 18:21. But select capable men from all the people, men who fear God, trustworthy men, who hate dishonest gain, and appoint them as officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. Well, Jethro's wisdom was revolutionary. Delegate. He advised Moses to find capable, trustworthy people from the community, men who fear God, were truthful, and hate dishonest gain, and appoint them as leaders over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. Moses would handle the great matters, and they would handle the small matters. This is our first lesson. A good leader knows they cannot do it all. True leadership is about being the one with the answer. Isn't the one about being with the answers. It's about empowering others, trusting them with responsibility, and distributing the workload. If you're overwhelmed, you're not just hurting yourself, you're also preventing others from stepping up and using their gifts. So we've talked about how smart of a man Moses was. So it's not too far of a stretch to think that Moses knew he might not get, or that he might get close to his own death before finishing. After all, he was 80 years old when they left Egypt and walked into the wilderness. Somewhere between a year and a half and 2 years, they reach the promised land, and the people reject Moses' plan. And God responds by saying they will wander for another 40 years. So here's an 80-year-old man who at that time was on the far end of a good life, being told he will be in the wilderness for another half of his lifetime. Now, any good leader is going to think ahead into the future and wonder, who is going to carry on the role when I'm gone? It's not clear when Moses began to mentor Joshua. All we know is that he put him in charge of leading the army to beat the Amalekites, and then again went up on Mount Sinai. These two traits are just great practice. And some 3,500 years later, it is so common it literally is just commonplace in what we do today of putting people around us. What is more remarkable about Jethro's advice is Moses' humility. He was the one who had spoken to God. He had performed miracles. He is the one who had just led the people out of Egypt. So he could have easily said, Jethro, I got this. You don't understand the spiritual weight of this. But he didn't. He listened. He took the counsel and put it into practice. This act of listening demonstrates the first part of effective mentoring, the willingness to be mentored. Jethro wasn't a prophet or a miracle worker. He was a wise and experienced man who saw a problem, and Moses honored that wisdom. Let's contrast these two men here. Moses was highly educated by the greatest minds in the most advanced country of the day. Jethro was a rancher in the desert. Midian, to be exact. If you haven't been there before, don't worry, I haven't either. But it is a very barren and desolate place, even more so than, you know, about 2 miles that way. Something similar to this picture here, that is believed to be in the area of Midian. So you want to hang out there for a little while and live out there, not just go hike? Anyway, this is where Jethro lived. And yet Moses submits to his father-in-law. Jethro, an uneducated desert rancher. And Moses, the highly educated man, trained to lead the most advanced country of the day. That's the kind of respecting your elders that we should have. And the story does come full circle. Later, Moses becomes the mentor. Deuteronomy 31:7-8. Then Moses summoned Joshua and said to him, "In the presence of all Israel, be strong and courageous, for you must go with the people into the land that the Lord swore to their ancestors to give them, and you will see that they will inherit it. The Lord himself goes before you and will be with you. He will never leave you nor forsake you. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged." He doesn't just delegate. He actively prepares his successor, Joshua. He takes Joshua under his wing, brings him up the mountain, and commissions him publicly. This intentional training shows that a great leader's job isn't done until the next generation is ready to take their place. Probably the most famous part of this story is the 40 years in the wilderness. It wasn't a mistake. The wilderness was a necessary part of the journey. In fact, Moses himself had to wait 40 years in the desert as a shepherd before God called him. He wasn't ready for leadership when he first tried. You know, when he killed the Egyptian to try to start taking over. That he was jumping ahead of God's timing. The 40 years for the Israelites served a similar purpose. It was a time of purification, of stripping away the mindset of slaves and building a new identity as a covenant people. It was a time to learn to trust God for every meal, every drink, and every direction. It was a time of preparation. Deuteronomy 8:2. "Remember how the Lord your God led you all the way in the wilderness these 40 years, to humble and test you in order to know what is in your heart, whether or not you would keep his commands." Sometimes we feel like we are wasting time in our own wilderness periods, a season of waiting, a job that feels stagnant, a period of singleness. These are often the moments where we are being shaped, where we are learning patience, humility, and dependence on God. The wilderness is not a punishment. It is a profound classroom. Or at least we should be treating it that way. In my own story, I did not get married when I wanted to, which was right out of college that I never actually finished. I didn't get married until 2 weeks before I turned 42. See, I graduated high school, turned 19, and then had to wait 23 years myself. God had to work on me. I had to get to the place where God needed me to be the man for my wife and my kid. Moses didn't take himself so seriously. He just did the next task in front of him. So I'm probably going to step on some toes here. So just hang with me here on this one, and I'll get to my point with it. I am not a fan of LeBron James. And nobody's going to make me a fan. I will say, he is an incredible talent in the modern NBA. That's the last positive you'll hear from me on him. So I live in Oregon, not too far out of Portland. So I grew up a Portland Trailblazer fan, as you can see in the picture here of me as a five-year-old. This would have been about a year after they won their only ever championship. Take a moment on that one. Thank you. So in 1984 rolls around, and we pick Sam Bust-A-Leg Bowie instead of Michael Jordan, later to be named the worst draft choice in sports history ever. Needless to say, I was not a Jordan fan during his playing career. However, I am today. But for the reasons I am a fan today are actually the same reasons I was not a fan back then. Jordan was the greatest talent in the game during his career. He was an incredible court leader. He even was a leader on a team of leaders. He was the best player on the team of the best players. He was even the star on the team of stars. You see, Jordan lifted up his teammates. James lifts up himself. Jordan takes the blame. James assigns the blame. Jordan leads. James does what he wants. Jordan and James are both stars and are both in a position of authority. James touts his stardom and expects others to do the same. Jordan went out and just did his job. Despite his incredible position, Moses never acted like a superstar. He was called the most humble man on the face of the earth. He wasn't focused on his own legacy or fame. He was focused on the next task: building a tabernacle, judging a dispute, striking a rock, leading the people to the next camp. He did the next thing God wanted him to do. Numbers 12:3. Now Moses was a very humble man, more humble than anyone else on the face of the earth. Think about how much we in the modern world get bogged down in thinking about our brand or our long-term strategy or our own personal mission statement. Moses' example reminds us of the power of presence and obedience. The grand plan belonged to God. The humble task belonged to him. Just do the next thing. I'm sure we've all heard stories of companies and organizations that lost a key leader and had to struggle because they did not have a succession plan in place. So fire yourself, but make sure you train your replacement. The question I always ask when I'm in a group that has a leader, a strong leader, what happens if you get hit by a bus? What's next? In my office, this is the driving force behind the trainings, manuals. Our office manager, she has worked for us, for our family, for 25 years. I don't worry about things not getting done. However, I'm just smart enough to know someone might run into her on her drive to work. What then? How do I pay the bills? What is the process? How do I process payroll? Pay the payroll taxes. So over the last couple of years, she has been updating procedural manuals and taking me through how to do all these things. just in case. A little over 18 and a half years ago, my dad hired me on so he could fire himself and retire-ish. He took years of taking me to meetings, explaining to me how he does things the way he does them, and truly mentoring me so he could take more time away and his business would continue to go forward. He planned his own firing, and one day I'll do the same. This is a very countercultural concept in leadership. A great leader works themselves out of a job. They don't hoard the power or knowledge. They give it away freely. Moses' great act of leadership was preparing Joshua to take over the very task he himself was not allowed to finish. Now, this requires immense humility and trust. It means seeing the big picture, the success on the mission, not just your personal role in it. Moses did not let personal pride get in the way of God's plan. He poured into Joshua, and in doing so, ensured the mission would continue after his death. This is true succession planning, and it's a testament to Moses' character. Mark 10:43-45. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be the first, be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. 2 Timothy 2:2. And the things you have heard me say in the presence of many witnesses, entrust to reliable people who will also be qualified to teach others. This is a New Testament parallel of the idea of succession planning. So how about some lessons from the location? The laws given to Moses, including the foundational Ten Commandments, were not delivered in a temple or a palace. They were delivered in the raw, untamed wilderness. The desert is a place where you have to let go of distractions. There are no comforts, no crowds, no easy answers. It's just you and God. This is a very powerful symbol. It suggests that our greatest moments of revelation and understanding often come not in a place of comfort, but in place of quiet, stripped down dependence. Exodus 19:18. Mount Sinai was covered with smoke because the Lord descended on it in fire. The smoke billowed up from it like smoke from a furnace, and the whole mountain trembled violently. This shows God was there with them. The law was given in the desert to a people who had to learn to rely solely on God for every need. The Festival of Sukkot, the Festival of Booths, the Feast of Tabernacles, is a living reminder of this period. For a week, we get together in temporary shelters. Hopefully, it's a little more than that. Recalling these temporary dwellings the Israelites were in the desert. It is a tangible way to remember the vulnerability, the provision, and the lessons of that 40-year journey. It reminds us that the Torah, the very heart of their identity, was forged in that wilderness classroom. My church history is full of examples of not being the church in community, tabernacling. Jesus' instruction was not build a church building and worship only there. That was the practice of his day that he spent 3 years calling out. No, his instruction was go into the world and be the church. Before the tabernacle was built and the formal Levitical priesthood was established, the very first laws about worship were about living in community, the civil laws of Leviticus, the laws about caring for the poor and not holding a grudge were all how they should live with their neighbors. The early foundation of faith was about their daily lives together. Leviticus 19:18. Do not seek revenge or bear a grudge against anyone among your people, but love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. This is the cornerstone verse that shows us worship and faithfulness are fundamentally about community conduct and living and loving one's neighbor. This challenges our modern idea of worship. We often think of worship as being something that happens inside of a building on a specific day of the week. But the fundamental teaching of the Israelites was it was their worship was expressed in how they treated others, in their civil life, in their neighborhoods. The tabernacle would come later, but first, they had to learn to live together. Now, I'm not saying being in a church or part of a church is wrong or a bad thing. That's our classroom, to go out and be the church outside of the classroom. Moses' journey shows us true leadership isn't just about giving orders. It's about listening to wisdom, empowering others, preparing the next generation, and humbly doing the next task in front of you. It teaches us that our wilderness seasons are not wasted time, but moments of profound growth and spiritual learning. And most importantly, it reminds us that our faith is not something to be confined to a building, but lived out in our neighborhoods and among our neighbors. Okay. If you walk away with only one thing that I've said this morning, please don't let it be that Michael Jordan is the GOAT. But let it be this. Moses is one of the great examples of how we can each, Moses is one of the great examples of how we can be in our lives every day. So a quick review. The burden of leadership is delegating, mentoring. The wilderness classroom teaches us patience and preparation, humility and focus, and succession planning. The lessons from the location itself. The desert is a spiritual place. It is a living tradition. Sukkot, Feast of Tabernacles. Community as worship. The last thing I have, Moses is our goat. Thank you. It's time for questions if you have any. Hopefully not NBA questions.
I'd like to make a comment. Host.
Oh, don't call me Mr. It's too close to Master. You did a good job. You put it all together real well. There's just a few things I'd word a little bit differently. Moses was, in my estimation, the intercessor for the chosen nation of Israel. He is actually a Jesus Christ type. And God the Father led them with a pillar of fire by night and the cloud by day. And I think they were punished with 40 years in the wilderness because only two of the spies said, no, we can take them, even though they're giants, and that was Joshua and Caleb. And so the first generation all died out, and only Joshua and Caleb got to go into the promised land. And that's the rest of them didn't. And Moses, he might have made a few mistakes, but the main one was when he struck the rock. And it plainly says that he wasn't weak in eyes or anything else. I think he's 125 years old and probably would have went in there and kicked those and acted them himself if he had been allowed to go into the promised land. But you was very thorough and put it together well. That's just a different way of looking at it. And we still have the same intercessors and leaders. And my sheep hear my voice, and we follow him. So I think you did a real good job. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bueller. Okay, well, thank you.